Jihad Awareness Network. This is Paul Sutliff, and I'm going to share with you a story, a well-documented story, about the Hijra, the beginning of Islam. They will tell you that Islam did not start with the Hijra, but the truth of the matter is, year zero of Islam is the beginning of the Hijra. The Hijra is the beginning of the Islamic calendar. And again, what I'm going to read to you is the beginning of a book that I have written. And it will be hopefully someday marketed towards educators to replace the misinformation found in textbooks. What you're going to hear should shock you. It should awe you. And you should be angry, you should be sad, and you should be full of emotion regarding the lies about what this really says. And again, this is all from primary resources. I'm not making any of this up. And I will tell you what the primary sources are. And here we go, the beginning of this journey. The beginning of my chapter is called The First Hijra, a Documented Story. Background. Why did Muhammad leave Mecca? It had been his home for most of his life. What could cause a man to send his followers through a dangerous desert environment to a place called Yathrib, which is Medina? That part of this story is essential to understanding why Islam calls the Hijra the beginning of Islam by the Muslim calendar. Muhammad had been a merchant and was well liked and known by many. He seemed to be able to quell difficulties between clans before he had his first encounter with an angel. The story goes that Muhammad worked on the rebuilding of the Kaaba after a flood wreaked havoc. He helped to rebuild the one to fame that the Mecca had. The Kaaba was symbolic of Mecca at the time of Muhammad. It was filled with idols and representations of gods and goddesses. Mecca was known for tolerance of religious beliefs and of others. Even some who were Jews and Christians found their faith respected as long as they also respected the beliefs of others. Mecca was a place thousands of polytheists made pilgrimages to once a year. Here they followed many rituals, from praying in a certain manner to circling the Kaaba so many times as they prayed, to running between the idols. The Meccans made a lot of their income from the pilgrims that visited every year. The pilgrimage required coordinating events, security, and places for pilgrims to stay. Meccans divided these duties up amongst their clans, some benefiting financially, some benefiting politically from being in charge of such an important event to their area. The pilgrimage required Meccans to respect everyone's gods and goddesses who came to the Kaaba to worship. One of the reasons pilgrims came to Mecca to worship was the presence of the black rock that's fell to the earth. The stone implies that a falling meteorite fell to the earth and was such a marvel that people in the area made the very place and the stone into a place of worship. But Muhammad worked on rebuilding the Kaaba while he was a polytheist. Everyone wanted the honor of placing the black stone. As the matter was being argued out, they decided, according to Ibn Ishaq's Sirah, the first biography of Muhammad, he recorded this part of the story. To make the first man, as the matter was being argued over, they made the first man to enter the gate of the mosque the umpire in the matter of dispute. They did so, and the first to come in was the apostle of Allah. When they saw him, they said, "This is the trustworthy one. We are satisfied. This is Muhammad." When he came to them and informed them of the matter, he said, "Give me a cloak." And it was brought to him, and he took the black stone and put it inside it, and said that each tribe should take hold of an end of the cloak, and they should lift it together. They did this, so that when they got into position, and he placed it with his own hand, and then the building went on above it. If this story is true, the cooperativeness of the Meccans with polytheist Muhammad, simple suggestion suggests that he was not just a person who could be trusted at this time. He was also a man of wisdom. Muhammad was under the care of his uncle, Abu Talib, until he married Khadija. Life was simple and successful for the merchant family until the day Muhammad's son died. He had sought out the gods and goddesses in the Kaaba, pleading for his son's life. None of them saved him. As every loving parent who has lost a son can testify, this devastated Muhammad to his core. According to Muhammad, during his grieving, he was visited by an angel. He went to his wife, fearful that he was going insane. Now, we know this because Bukhari records this story given by Aisha, his child bride. Now, she said, "The commencement of the divine inspiration to Allah's messenger was in the form of true dreams in his sleep. He had never had a dream, but it turned out to be true. And clear as the bright daylight, then he began like seclusion. So he used to go in seclusion in the cave of Hira, where he used to worship Allah continuously for many nights before going back to his family to take the necessary provisions of food for the day. He came back to his wife Khadija again to take the provisions of food. Likewise, till one day he received the guidance. While he was in the cave of Hira, an angel came to him and asked him to read. Allah's messenger replied, 'I do not know how to read.' The prophet added, 'Then the angel held me forcibly and pressed me so hard that I felt distressed. Then he released me, and again he told me to read, and I replied, "I do not know how to read." Thereupon he held me again and pressed me for the second time, till I felt distressed. He then released me and asked me to read, but again I replied, "I do not know how to read." Thereupon he held me for the third time and pressed me, till I got distressed, and then he released me and said, "Read in the name of your Lord, who has created all that exists, has created man out of a clot. Read, and your Lord is the most generous, who has taught the writing by the pen, has taught man that which he knew not." That's 96:1-5. That's Surah 96:1-5. Then Allah's messenger returned with that experience and that muscles between his neck and shoulders were trembling till he came upon Khadijah, his wife, and said, "Cover me." They covered him. And when the state of fear was over, he said to Khadijah, "Oh, Khadijah, what's wrong with me? I was afraid that something bad might happen to me." Then he told her the story. Khadijah said, "Nay, but receive the good tidings. By Allah, Allah will never disgrace you, for by Allah you keep good relations with your kith and kin. Speak the truth, help the poor and the destitute, entertain your guests generously, and assist those who are stricken with calamities." Now, think about this. Khadijah and her uncle, Waraka, told Muhammad that he was a prophet of Allah, the only God. This was the beginning of a controversy in Mecca, for Allah was not a new God to Meccans. Allah had been worshipped at the Kaaba along with many other gods. The difference came in that Muhammad began to tell others they were worshipping false gods. He was not in the least respectful of what others wished to believe. Muhammad would tell tales he claimed were of Judaism and their God as proof that he was a prophet of God, and as such, Jewish people should also respect him. But the stories Muhammad told were examples of listening to a pipeline of persons retelling a tale, which had been revised many times by the point he told it. Keep in mind, Muhammad had stated he could not read, so he could not view the Torah and read how far off he was. But it was not just the Jewish people of Mecca who had issues with his claims to be a prophet. Meccans were angered by his claims of serving a superior God to that of the others. Local poets laughed and mocked his ignorance of the actual stories of the Jewish people. Being mocked by poets was something that Muhammad would not forgive nor forget. According to Ibn Ishaq's Sirah, again, this is a part of his biography, Muhammad's biography. One time, as Muhammad and his few followers were praying, things got violent. When the apostles' companions prayed and went to the glen so that their people could not see them praying, and Asad, Abu Waqas, was with a number of the prophet's companions in one of the glens of Mecca, a band of polytheists came upon them while they were praying and rudely interrupted them. They blamed them for what they were doing until they came to blows. And it was on that occasion that Sa'd smote a polytheist with the jawbone of a camel and wounded him. This was the first blood to be shed in Islam. And now back to my part of the book. Many of the Meccans began to regard Muhammad no longer as someone to be trusted and thought of him as an enemy. Muhammad was 40 years old when he started preaching for Allah. The Meccans sought to expel him for the good of all Meccans. But Abu Talib, his uncle, was a man of power. He treated his adopted son with favor. Because of this, Muhammad was protected. The Meccans recognized his love for an adopted son. They were not without understanding of the situation. They sought to help Abu Talib release his nephew, Muhammad, to them by offering Abu Talib another adopted son. This is, again, a story in Ibn Ishaq's Sirah. Here's what Ibn Ishaq records this as. When the Quraysh perceived that Abu Talib had refused to give up the apostle and that he was resolved to part company with them, they went to him and said, "According to my information, O Abu Talib, this is Umara, the strongest and most handsomest young man among the Quraysh. So take him, and you'll have the benefit of his intelligence and support. Adopt him as a son and give up this nephew of yours, who was opposed to religion and the religion of your fathers. Sever the unity of your people and mock our way of life so that we may kill him. This will be a man for man." Abu Talib refused and continued to protect Muhammad to the day he died. Tension grew. The citizens of Mecca boycotted Muhammad and his followers by refusing to trade with them for food in hopes that they would change religion or leave Mecca. However, as in the case of many boycotts, some people crossed the line and gave Muhammad's followers food. These things really heated up when Muhammad heard members of his tribe, the Quraysh, discussing him. Again, another story in Ibn Ishaq's Sirah. They said that they had never known anything like the trouble they had endured this from this fellow. They had declared their mode of life foolish, insulted their forefathers, reviled their religion, divided their community, and cursed their gods. What they had borne was past all bearing or word of words to that effect. While they were discussing him, the apostle came towards them and kissed the black stone. When he passed by them as he entered the temple, Muhammad began the prayer walk around the Kaaba. As he passed, they said some insulting things about him. This I could see from his expression. He went on and passed them a second time. They attacked him again with words. This I could see from his expression. Then he passed the third time, and they did the same. He stopped and said, "Will you listen to me, O Quraysh? By him who holds my life in his hand, I bring you slaughter." Now, let me ask you, if someone made this threat to your city or town, what would you do? The Quraysh were livid, and yet they did not expel him from the city, for Abu Talib, Muhammad's uncle, was his protector.
The Meccan have on the line with us, however, one of our top security experts, Frank Gaffney.
They waited for more of these threats and then attacked the Muslims, imprisoning them, beating them, increasing the pressure of the boycott so that they received no food or drink. Some were left exposed to the heat of the desert to endure its harshness, to renounce the God of Muhammad, some did. Muhammad recognized the dangers and sent some of his followers to Abyssinia for their safety. According to Muhammad Haykel's Life of Muhammad, translated by Ismail al-Faruqi, Muhammad advised his followers to go to the Christian kingdom of Abyssinia, because a king rules without justice, a land of truthfulness, until God leads us to a way out of our difficulty. The Quraysh were angered when they discovered that many of the Muslims had fled. They did not want them to leave as much as they desired to have them change their religion. For this reason, they sent two men to the king of Abyssinia to ask for their return. The king had promised the followers of Muhammad's safety, so he refused to send them back. Muhammad had turned 50. It was now 10 years after his first vision, and many of the Muslims had left to live in safety across the Red Sea. Muhammad was not doing well earning new converts, and many had left Islam because of the boycott and persecution. He was asked by the Quraysh if he would worship their gods so that they in turn would worship his Allah. He refused, but it appears he did not do so fully. Again, according to the Ibn Ishaq's Sirah, this is a quote, "When the apostle saw the people turn their backs on him, and he was pained by the estrangement from which he brought them from Allah, he longed that there should come to him from Allah a messenger, a message that would reconcile his people to him, if the obstacle that made him so difficult could be removed, that he meditated on the project and made his task so difficult and longed for it. It was dear to him. Then Allah sent down by the star, when it sets your comrade errs not, it is not deceived. He speaks not from his own desire. And when he reached his words, have you thought of Allah and Al-Izzah and the Nath? The third, the other, Satan, when he was meditating upon it, desiring to bring it to reconciliation to his people, put upon his tongue. These are the exalted Ghani, whose intercession is approved." When the Quraysh heard this, they were delighted and greatly pleased by the way in which he spoke of their God. And they listened to him. While the believers were holding what their prophet brought them from their Lord was true, and not suspecting a mistake or a vain desire or a slip. Now, think about this. This was the type of answer the Meccans and Muhammad tribesmen, the Quraysh, had been looking for. This was acceptance of their polytheistic ways. They were thrilled, and things began to improve for everybody. The people of Abyssinia heard the Quraysh as a whole had accepted Islam and began to make plans to return home. Things truly seemed blissful for the people of Mecca. Once again, they were a happy family, a cohesive working family, but it was not to last. Muhammad claimed he was visited by the angel Jibril, Gabriel, who was quite upset that he, Muhammad, had delivered a message not from him. Allah was not happy. This is from Ibn Ishaq's Sirah. "We have not sent a prophet or apostle before you, But when he longed, Satan cast suggestions into his longing. But Allah will annul what Satan has suggested. Then Allah will establish his verses, Allah being known and wise. How can the intercession of their gods avail with him? Muhammad recanted what he said and infuriated his tribesmen, the Quraysh. This, it seemed to them, meant Muhammad may lie to them to get what he wants. The Quraysh were eager to toss him out of the city, dead or alive, but his uncle Abu Talib still protected him. The followers of Muhammad were returning from Abyssinia when they learned that they had been deceived about the Quraysh following Muhammad. They returned home in secret or with oath of protection for their safety. Things got so bad now, Muhammad began to leave Mecca to find allies who allowed his followers to find a safe haven. But what he was seeking was more than a safe haven to worship as he chose. He was seeking a military ally who would join his people in battle when they needed them. One encounter did not go so well. According to Muhammad's first biographer, Ibn Ishaq, he went to Amir, the Sasa'a tribe. According to Ibn Ishaq, Baharia Firas said, "By God, if I could take this man, the Quraysh, I could eat up the Arabs with him." Then he said, "If we actually give allegiance to you and God gives you the victory over your opponents, shall we have authority after you?" Muhammad replied, "Authority is a matter which Allah places where he pleases." Firas answered, "I suppose you want us to protect you from the Arabs with our breath. And then if God gives you victory, someone else will reap the benefit." "Thank you, no." When Firas gave the report to his people and told them of a man of the Quraysh pretending to be a prophet, seeking protection and their military might so that he might attack and retake Mecca. Now, this is important. You have to understand that this was part of the intent. He was intending to leave Mecca and come back with a military might. This was his intent in achieving a treaty. So during this time, you know, that he's looking amongst the people's following around Mecca, he meets somebody from Yathrib, and he shares of his Quran, which Allah has revealed to him. Muhammad recites phrases from it. Remember, he can't read them, so he can't quote what he said before. And the man returned to his prophet, his people. According to tradition, that man returned to Yathrib, and the people there started to become they were the Quraysh, started to become Muslim. So, Yathrib, which was later renamed Medina, like Mecca, Yathrib was the home to more than one tribe, and not all of them got along. According to one of Muhammad's biographers, Ibn Ishaq, the Quraysh tribe lived side by side with the Jewish tribe. Whenever difficulties arose between the Jews would raid raid the Quraysh. Ibn Ishaq added that during these times, the Jewish tribe of Yathrib claimed a prophet would be sent and they would kill the Quraysh. Muhammad's timing couldn't have been better. The Quraysh were feeling vulnerable and feared that what would happen if a Jewish tribe accepted Muhammad as their prophet. This led to a continual discussion of what the prophet named Muhammad could do for them. According to Ibn Ishaq, there was no home of the Quraysh where Muhammad's name was not spoken of. They all became followers of Muhammad. It became a goal of the tribe to seek out Muhammad before the Jewish tribe found him and claimed him as their own. 1 year later, they gave the prophet a pledge of women and later agreed to a military alliance. Now, the Meccans had long known of Muhammad's attempts to gain a military strength against them. They watched him fail time after time, and it likely became a joke amongst them until he achieved it with the Quraysh tribe. The leaders of the Quraysh saw an encampment of the Quraysh outside Mecca and went to it to question them. They had concerns about a group that would pledge a war against them, wouldn't you? Again, this is according to Ibn Ishaq Sirah, right straight from the mouth of his first biographer. It says, "With the morning, the leader of the Quraysh came to the encampment, saying that they had heard that we had come to invite Muhammad to leave Mecca. and had pledged ourselves to support him in war against them, and that there was no Arab tribe that they would fight more reluctantly than us. Thereupon, the polytheists of our tribe swore that nothing of the kind had happened. I'm talking about the Quraysh, were saying that they didn't know anything about this. Now, this is interesting, because it clearly revealed the Quraysh were using men unaware of the pledge. The Quraysh were not as trusting of those who were unaware of the pledge. Something seemed off to them. They returned home to Mecca to investigate further the claim that Muhammad had formed a military alliance to attack their city. It was not long before they verified the claim as being truthful, and they left with a force to attack the encampment. They achieved the goal of dispersing the Quraysh men of Yathrib, capturing one of them, and they beat him until it was revealed that the man they had captured had offered protection to some of their own. Regardless of how they felt about what his tribesmen were going to do, they freed the man. Muhammad and his followers remained in Mecca, despite the hardships of persecution and attacks by the followers Mecca. Little changed until the day Muhammad claimed to have received an order to fight from Allah. Again, from Ibn Ishaq. Permission is given to those who fight because they have been wrong. Allah is able to help them. Those who have been driven out of their houses without right only because they said Allah is our Lord, I have allowed them to fight only because they have been unjustly treated, while their sole offense against men has been what they worship Allah. Then and only then did Muhammad give the order to migrate Hijra, the Yathrib. The Meccan Muslims left for the 280-mile trek to join the Quraysh, whom they would forever call the helpers. This was the beginning of the 88-day journey. Now, Muhammad, he's now 53 years old, he knew that if he left with his followers, they would be attacked and likely decimated. He made sure that the Meccans knew he was staying. The Meccans were aware of the followers of Muhammad leaving. They had long debated what to do. Debate over imprisoning him ended when the conclusion that the prison would be attacked and he would be freed. Another thought had been to drive him out into a foreign country. After much thought, that concluded that Muhammad's gifted speech would recruit an army to attack them, being no different than the situation they felt they were already in. The only other solution was to execute him by assassination or other means. Muhammad knew of the plan to kill him, but not the when and where. The Islamic story of escape from Mecca has him placing his green mantle on Ali, who slept in his bed while Muhammad escaped. Ibn Ishaq tells of Muhammad walking past blinded guards who waited outside his house. Muhammad took the time to put dust on their heads. But this story does not end there. When Ali awoke and moved about, the guards became aware that Muhammad had escaped. Muhammad had escaped to Abu Bakr's house. Previously, Muhammad had asked Abu Bakr to wait to migrate. He and his family had stayed in Mecca. Abu Bakr purchased two camels for that purpose, awaiting the day he and Muhammad would leave. Now, notice he did not plan for his family to take the journey with him. That's a significant importance. That night, Muhammad and Abu Bakr escaped out a window, leaving Abu Bakr's family behind. According to his daughter, Asma, the future sister-in-law of Muhammad, her father left the house taking all of his money, leaving his wife and two daughters penniless. Again, this is found in Ibn Ishaq's story. The Quraysh were infuriated at Muhammad's escape from them and offered a reward of 100 camels to anyone who would bring him back. Muhammad and Abu Bakr stayed in a cave below Mecca for 3 days before setting out for Yathrib. According to a recent biography of Abu Bakr by Dr. Ali Salaabi, which is published in 2012, the Arabs waited for Muhammad and gave up waiting, and they went back to Yathrib. It was a Jew who first saw them approaching Yathrib, and he yells at the top of his lungs, "Oh, Arabs, here is your hope you have been waiting for." Dr. Salaabi then states, the Muslims picked up their weapons and went out to meet the messenger of Allah. It's important to understand that this migration had three purposes, the first of which the followers of Muhammad knew well, and they were escaping to a place that would no longer be persecuted. The second purpose of the Quraysh knew, of that it was to become a military alliance for them, to help defend them from the Jews. The last purpose Muhammad and some of his followers and the Quraysh leadership alone knew, that was they were going to Yathrib to grow an army to return and attack Mecca. The Hijra is the beginning of the Islamic calendar. This event marks the beginning of Islam as a political entity, not as a religion. It marks the beginning of a political entity that would grow and threaten the entire world. The claim that Islam is a peaceful religion is a denial of the purposes of the first Hijra, which are given in the Islamic record known as the Surah of Ibn Ishaq. Even the account by Dr. Salabi of the Muslims grabbing their weapons to go greet Muhammad denies it. Now, if you have a comment, I would love for you to call in and tell me what you think of this story so far. Please do call in. We'll take your calls. I would love to hear what people think. And as we're waiting to hear, take your call, I'd like to tell you that this story, this is just the beginning of several pieces. And I have been working on this, and one of the things I will say about this is I intend to finish this book and make it a much broader scope and market it two ways. One, it will be marketed to the average person, and I say that because it will be not marketed in a way towards teachers, and I do intend to make the teachers give them a cheaper chance at getting a hold of this book. This is only, I'm talking about the Hijra first, and this other stories about Muhammad that should wake people up. My concern is that we need to see many things happening. Please do call in. I'd love to hear what people think about what they just heard and tell me what they thought about what they just heard. The Hijra is so significant, and it is such a powerful piece that we need to look at and it's telling others there is more to this story than what they are telling you. The Hijra is so important in the fact that it was a ploy. He left so he could take people back. What I did find out, I want to tell you a few minutes about what I'm doing now. I can't talk about much. I am currently in Europe. I'm calling from Berlin. And the fun thing about what I'm doing is I'm on a fact-finding expedition on the Islamization of Europe. I cannot talk about where I am or what I've done. But I can say I'm having a lot of surprises. I'm finding that the people of Europe are saying one thing and the government is saying something entirely different. If this does not surprise people, it should. And I will tell very much more when I return to Toronto. I'm not allowed to comment publicly on anything until I return home. I'd say prepare for a really shocking show next week. You will find some very, eye-opening revelations, and I may end up having a guest from Europe on the show next week, which will explain what is happening here. There are some people here that want to tell the truth, and there are others who definitely do not want it known. And that is the sad thing about what you are hearing about in Europe. And I cannot give details, and I wish I could. Unfortunately, I have to wait. Watch around you for this Dakia that I keep warning people about. The story that I told is word for word from Muslim sources. It is from Muslim sources, and all I'm doing is sharing it. I say the citations and everything in the book. If we do not use their sources, if we do not share the truth using these Islamic sources, we're allowing people to tell us lies and to convince us of things that they believe to be, they know is a lie, and they're willing for us to believe these lies. We've got to stop being so accepting. This is my biggest concern and my biggest scream. We have to stop being people who, okay, yes, we have a caller.
Hey, Paul, it's Lauren, just calling to listen to what you have to say from the Middle East and Europe. Okay, well, it sounds like you've got some good, information coming from Europe right now today. I thought you did a really great job conveying some important truth to the audience today.
What do you think is the biggest surprise out of what you just heard?
Well, I'm not sure that I was surprised by too much of what you said, but maybe just the shock is that people are kind of acquiescing without much of a fight. We're watching this occur in a manner so that, you know, the enemy doesn't have to even raise a sword. The kind of, you know, cultural takeover where people, you know, are simply acquiescing to what the message is that the enemy is conveying rather than, you know, pushing back. That's a little surprising.
And to me, that is exactly, it's funny because that is, if you look at the story of the Hijra, that is exactly what it is. Cultural acceptance of a change. And that's kind of, it's a fight, the whole story is a fight against this. The Meccans fight the cultural change. They don't want it. And the cultural change that is being forced is not by anybody else but the Muslim. And if you think about all the way up to present day, that is a consistent story from the Muslim's perspective. And it is, again, aimed at everybody else. You're going to find this attack, I believe this is a purposeful, strained attack, whether they are coming into North America, Germany, France, Norway, wherever. And again, the move in, you know, let them move in. Let them learn the language, yes. But once they decide that they want to change change people into accepting what they believe as normal and as good, then we run into trouble because what they're asking for is for us to follow things like Sharia. Now, I will say this. This is the one thing that really surprised me in my trip is that we have people in power in various places around the world who think Sharia means this. You pray five times a day. You wash yourself. You pay your zakat, and they've refused to accept things like they cherry pick out of Sharia what they think is important. They ignore women.
You know, that's so true.
Can be children, child brides, and things like that. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
Lauren?
And basically, when you're over regulated, like they are with Sharia law. It's almost impossible to keep, you know, every single particular law. Even, you know, imams differ on punishment and things like that. But, you know, the ritualistic part of it, you know, isn't so dangerous. Many people, you know, many Babylonian idol worshippers had rituals. The dangerous part comes with the theocracy and the legal system of just like what you said is Sharia. And it's interesting that you use the word taqiyya. Am I saying that correctly?
Yes.
Yes. Well, it's almost like that has infiltrated into our Western civilization already, where you can conveniently get people to pay, you know, using their own tax money, certain things that allow for welfare benefits or however you want to call it. It's one of those situations that if it looks like taqiyya and it acts like taqiyya, it might be taqiyya. So I think we're seeing that in our Western cultures, something that we, you know, is sort of very foreign or novel in the way we used to have our judicial system and legal system and, you know, the way we did business over here from our societal perspective. And it kind of came in this in a stealth way. So it's not really, you know, the audience doesn't really need to beat themselves up for not knowing about it. But now that we are waking up to it and people's eyes are being opened, I think it's important that, you know, shows like yours educate people about what they can do.
I think what's was just said in the room is extremely important. The concept of self-censorship. Self-censorship is what is making this whole possibility of Islamic takeover possible. Once you start saying you don't want people to know something, there's a problem. Self-censorship is the reasoning that Hitler could take over. People stop saying, you know, hey, don't tell people. Don't say these things. We have serious issues when we start this censor. I won't say there can't be a good reason for censorship, but there are extreme problems when you start this censor. Let's take an example of you decide that it's important to censor people from knowing who Muhammad really is, or better yet, you decide to censor this simple rule that could be. Let's take a look at a simple rule that one lady I know may propose, and it has been proposed in Canada. You cannot insult the prophet. So that would be a form of censorship. Now, again, this rule would come out and say you can't insult any religion. Let's think about that. How would it be enforced? Someone's religion. Well, if you insult the Christians probably aren't going to say anything. You insult the Jews probably aren't going to say anything. You insult them, anybody, 99% of the people will not, you know, hey, they just look at it as a stupid rule and they won't say anything. But the Mohammedans, the Muslims, will immediately call the police and you will be taken away and charged. So this is the problem. And again, this was a proposed law in Canada. It made it far enough up to have a discussion in Ottawa, which to me was mind-blowing. To think that it could possibly exist in a government where they would say, well, you can't insult the prophet, you can't insult religion, they have that discussion, then you lose the concept of free speech. Unfortunately, many countries do not have this concept of free speech as in America. Canadians have and don't have it. The English do not have it. I mean, they've arrested people for quoting Winston Churchill. I still cannot understand that. If you are in England and you quote something and it seems to be insulting to Muhammad, you can lose your livelihood. These are dangers. For telling the truth about Islam, you can lose your livelihood in many places. And in Islamic countries, should you tell the truth about Muhammad and it be delivered in a truthful manner, we have a problem.
It's far too subjective, you see. And that's why in America, we have a fighting chance, because what's happened is they haven't created these laws through the proper channels, through due process, and Congress adopts it, and, you know, on the state level, local level, and federal level. However, what we have to fight now is executive orders that have come out. And I just recently in my research read one that Jay Johnson wrote, and it's completely subjective, and they're treating these executive orders as though they are laws. And he basically says, you know, we're going to enforce the immigration laws when it suits us and under our policies, and then really defers to foreign interests more than it does our own constitution. Now, here's an interesting, you know, paragraph that he wrote in this particular executive order that came out in 2014 that I think you'd be interested in too, is where it says if they do find somebody that they're considering deporting, which is not very many people that fall on that radar list, they will not pick them up if they're in a place of worship. So that really took my research to another level here in our country with, you know, so many mosques that have been allowed to be built in the United States of America, some with taxpayer grants. And you're looking at this like in an executive order coming from the presidential office and the subordinate agencies that they're picking and choosing. So basically, if they're not in a sanctuary city, they're almost saying, hey, look, you're in a mosque, you're going to have a get out of jail free card kind of thing. And that's something that we in America particularly, but also in the other countries that you just discussed, should be also aware of.
I did want to follow a comment that was made in the chat room, going back to the story I read. And I agree. I just want to say I agree 100% with Bob Beavers, and I'll get back to you in a minute, Laura. Bob Beavers is 100%, Bob Evers is 100% correct. The difficulty for me in following this story was looking for maps. I do have maps that are going to be placed in this, and I say I'll put it in, and putting them in there, because for me, following this story without maps is extremely difficult. So, yes, you can expect them to be in there. The cave locations, they are not provided in the map. That was also difficult for me to find because I spent about 20 hours at least looking for these maps, and I could not find anything designating the, quote, cave location. But there's fun to look at. Now, Lauren is 100% right, and this gets very, very significant. When you look at the former mosque that was to be put up as a Victory Mosque, where the World Trade Center was, the plans indicated that there were to be six separate rooms for people to live in at that mosque. Now, this is significant. Now, especially with what she's saying, if people were in a place of, quote, worship, then they have a problem if they can't go and arrest them. What is the purpose of even making that statement? It's to tell the Muslims, hey, if you want to gather, you want to be terrorists, you want to gather inside a mosque, oh, we'll wait outside for you to come out. Okay. Oh, we've been waiting about a week. Oh, no, a month. Okay, there's more in there now, maybe about a year. When do you say enough is enough? This is scary.
That's true.
No.
You know, that's exactly where the plan's made. Is
by the time you wait a month, they put another addition on. They've got an approval from the local town to add another floor to the building. And now you've got 25 people living there instead of six. And this is the danger that would come in. So six people go and commit acts of terror, and they get back to the mosque. They're safe. Oh, another six go out, not these guys, and they come back. They go commit acts of terror, and somebody figures out who they are. Oh, they get back in. Oh, now we got 12 people. Oh, so this is a whole game of defending the Muslim. Rather than it should not be. Now, the place of worship, again, is defined much differently by Muslims than it is defined by Christians, Jews, and anybody else. And that is, incredibly significant. Without understanding these things, we place ourselves in danger. We have to be looking at the Islamic scriptures, and we have to look at what they're really saying. If we're not watching for these things, we're not preparing ourselves for what they're planning, what they say they're going to do to us, we're being foolish. What I will say is these new immigration waves of Muslims, in some way, I thoroughly believe they are planned, but I have not been able to track that. The reason I say that they are somehow planned is that it is against Sharia for them to come to non-Muslim lands unless they have one of two intentions. One, this is the only legality of them coming to a non-Muslim land. One, they have to have been in a land where it was impermissible for them to worship. And then they're allowed to, as long as they're going to Western land, they're allowed to worship, that's okay. Then another exception. It should be that they're allowed to go to a Western country solely for the purpose of jihad or dawah. Now, this is what the Sharia says. It is they are only allowed to come for those two reasons. Again, if they come from a persecuted place where they're not allowed to worship, that is another thing.
if we understand these things as Westerners or non-Muslims, and they're coming into our country, you have to stop and ask yourself, why are they coming here? They're breaking their own laws by coming here. If their purpose is dawah, okay, maybe, you know, we don't have a problem with people sharing their faith. However, changing culture is another matter. I mean, I love my apple pie. I don't want anybody to change anybody, the concept of people making apple pie for me. I love apple pie. I mean, it sounds like something simple. But would that mean that down the road, we wouldn't be having apple pie. We would be maybe having something from the Muslim culture of things. These are important little things we have to think about. How important is your culture? This is one of the things I have that Mr. Pipes has done for us in this trip. He's shown us what great aspects of French culture there is, what great aspects of German culture there are. And in the next place, we're going to do the same thing. And this is the stuff that they could be losing. Now, the next place we're going, I've already heard another public speaker say that it is lost, that it will no longer be their country. It will be Islamic culture within 10 to 15 years because they are being outpopulated.
You know, Paul, though, if I could just say something about that. You know, I've heard a lot of people say that. That's part of the dialogue, almost like politically correct. Just because, and it is one factor when people start to multiply and outpopulate other cultures, but there are so many other factors that we just have to take back the message of authority. And, you know, if we start using...
Well, in this case, it is too late. They have been... because right now they are almost entirely outpopulated. And it will be within 10 years, most likely. And they are saying that this is... I have to say thank you. Thank you for listening and calling in, Lauren. I have to say, wonderful. So I just say we've had some wonderful people listening. Bob Evers, Bigfoot, Dodds. I cannot. Doc, Gary Comfort. I think it is. Thank you all for listening. And again, this is Global Patriot Radio. And the cool thing about being Global Patriot Radio is there are patriots from all over the world, and you can really believe they exist. And when you hear them here, you know there's truth to be told. I just want to say thank you all for being here and giving a chance for me to have a voice to share what I think is important with you. God bless you all, and let's run that end clip. Cal, thank you.
American girls and American guys, we'll always stand up and salute. We'll always recognize when we see your glory flying. There's a lot of men dead, so we can sleep in peace at night when we lay down our heads. My daddy served in the army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard till the day that he died. He wanted my mother, my brother, my sister, and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free. Now this nation that I love is falling under attack. A mighty sucker punch came flying in from somewhere in the back. Soon as we could see clearly through our big black eye, man, we lit up your world like the 4th of July. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And an eagle will fly, and it's gonna be here. When you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell, and it'll feel like the whole of the red, white, and blue.
dog will fight when you rattle his cage. You'll be sorry that you mess with the U.S. of A. Cause we'll put a boot in your ass.